Welcome to Heavy Pod is Heavy Cast, episode 93, and yay, we have the regular lineup again. That's Eden and me.
We're getting close to 100, dude.
Yeah.
We need to start thinking about what we're not doing.
Yeah. I mean, also, 104 is going to be like 2 years for us. Well, we skipped 1 week, so actually 103 is going to be our like 2 year anniversary.
We don't celebrate anniversaries until 256.
No, not until 420.
420. I'll be dead by then.
Probably.
I'll be hit by a Nazi in a car.
Oh God.
Topical.
God.
Yeah.
Okay. So, speaking of Nazis, we have an interesting piece of news. So, remember a few weeks ago we talked about, was it the guy from Coldplay, Thom Yorke?
Oh my God. Was that sarcastic? That was smooth.
Yeah. Anyway, so Thom Yorke was, you know, there was this whole deal about Radiohead playing in Israel. And then it was like, no, you guys shouldn't do that. If you do that, you support like Israel and the occupation.
So just for context, it was Roger Waters who said that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So Roger Waters, and then Thom Yorke was like, you know what? We're just going to go play. Who cares? And now Roger Waters is saying, by playing in Israel, Thom Yorke and Radiohead are supporting the Israeli government and thus the occupation. He even says, this is a quote from Waters, Thom Yorke is wrong about not endorsing the policies of the Israeli government by playing there. Spokespersons of that government have said how excited they are, that this is the best thing that's happened to their Hasbara. I don't know what that is.
That's Hasbara is like Israeli efforts abroad to, you can take it to either mean propaganda or
like
if you're
Hallyu Wave.
Yeah. Okay. But that's on the negative side. Their connotation is like improving Israel's image in the world, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah. So, like, again, Radiohead aren't endorsing anything. It's just that, well, I mean, the Israeli government is obviously excited by this. And, like, saying that the government is excited by this is not an indictment of Thom Yorke.
And also, citation needed, because I haven't seen any official from the Israeli government say anything about Radiohead. No one has like paraded the fact that Radiohead played in Israel as like an endorsement of the Israeli government's policies. So I don't know what the fuck he's talking about.
Well, Ben from our staff, well, not staff, family said that Palestine can only be freed by a celebrity musician taking pot shots at each other. And that kind of encapsulates this. I think last time we spoke about this, our stance on this was generally kind of like, you know, not playing there doesn't actually achieve anything. And if you go and play there, you can actually take a stance against the government.
And, yeah. And the thing I want to add here, like, there is stuff that you can do as a celebrity. Part of the ways in which the occupation works, and not just this occupation, but occupations in general, is by being secretive, right? It's by not showing.
Well, except for Occupy Wall Street.
Yeah, but those guys are also Nazis. It's not about secrecy in the sense of, you know, not talking about anything and being super confidential. It's about obscuring the facts and making sure that people aren't aware of what's actually happening. And you, as Roger Waters, there is something that you can do. You can, for example, say, did you know that fishermen in Gaza can't feed their families because Israeli siege prevents them from going out into deep water and fishing? Did you know that that's a thing? Did you know that the IDF like regularly targets economic sources in the Gaza Strip to make people's lives harder? You can really do something to pressure other people into acting, but not performing here achieves absolutely nothing. Like, that's not enough. That's not activism.
Yeah. Similar to how Bono was not performing in, and I think I brought this up last time too, Bono not performing in Turkey because the Turkish government supports the Armenian genocide denial. Like, nobody in Turkey actually cares, you know? Like, very few people care. And, like, if they came here and made a big, like, pro-genocide is not the right way to put it, but you know what I mean. A big statement about the genocide, then that would actually make some waves in the local media. Like, that would actually generate some conversation. But by not playing, you're just like, okay, cool, bye.
Yep, you basically give up ground to the other side and you achieve absolutely nothing.
Speaking of achieving absolutely nothing, apparently Jeff Loomis was not allowed to write anything on the new Arch Enemy album.
Which is really bizarre.
Yes. So,
like,
Michael Amott, who is kind of the Michael Keane of Arch Enemy, has said basically that he wants to kind of preserve the Arch Enemy sound, right? So, that's stupid in several ways. First of all, the sound is kind of stale at this point, and some injection of new blood would be cool. Secondly, Jeff is talented. He can write in other styles than his own. And beyond that, Jeff's own style is actually really close to Arch Enemy's style. So you could totally see a fusion going on there. Also, like, Jeff is a better guitar player than you, dude. Just let him improve the band.
Yeah, and he's like trying to spin this as, it's no big deal, we have great chemistry, blah, 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 blah. It is a big deal when you have a brand name guitarist,
yeah,
whose identity can refresh your sound, you refresh your fan base, and you just let him sit there stale. And, you know, I don't know Jeff Loomis, obviously, and haven't heard him speak about composition, but I would guess he could be flexible and meet you halfway. Yeah. So the excuse of, it's just not the style, it's kind of bullshit, it sounds more like an ego thing, where yeah, you want to keep the reins of power in your hands. It's just idiotic. It's like buying the best quarterback on the league and then not letting them play.
And also, again, like, Jeff's own style itself already is pretty similar to how Arch Enemy sound like. So yeah, it's particularly pointless. But as for Jeff's versatility, he's played solos in, like, Annihilator, Isan, Hannes Grossman's album, Nevermore, obviously. He has several solo albums. He's played with Marty Friedman. He's played in Periphery, remember? He was in yeah, Jetpacks. So yeah, he can do stuff.
Yeah, and I had something. Oh yeah, how edgy is it to release an album called Will to Power?
Yeah, well, that's Arch Enemy for you.
Yeah, so fucking edgy.
Speaking of being edgy,
where are you going with this?
So it feels like these days music journalism just doesn't have that same edge anymore.
Wow, did you stretch before that?
Actually, like, stretching my fingers. Okay, so Wall Street Journal posted this pretty interesting article titled "What Happened to the Negative Music Review?" So it's a good point, because early in the article they point out that, you know, movie reviews are often pretty critical of movies. Like, if you go to Rotten Tomatoes, you will see that there's a big breadth of opinions for movies, and, like, it is not uncommon for, like, big budget popular movies to get pretty negative reviews. Mm-hmm. So, whereas if you look at music scores are overwhelmingly really positive.
Yeah.
Like, at this point, it's, and they quote a Vice writer here, at this point, when an album gets a bad review, it's actually news.
Mm-hmm.
So, and they kind of outline a few reasons why this happens, and we can kind of relate to some of these as well. So, first of all, the press is less dependent on the big studios for movie reviews. For music reviews, I think the thing is, you can just check out an album on streaming for, like, very little effort on your part.
Yeah.
And then you can kind of form your opinion on it. Whereas with movies, you know, you have to spend a decent amount of money, make a time investment, go to the movies, and stuff like that. Secondly, the fact that artists oftentimes kind of drop albums without a big hype cycle. Like, if you're gonna release a big budget movie, you market it for, like, several years, right? Like, from yeah, the first teaser trailer to the
actual release. Yeah.
Yeah. It takes quite a bit of time. And even before the teaser trailer, you know, there's always, like, word of mouth and stuff. Whereas, like, look at, did Beyonce kind of drop her album out of nowhere? She did, right? And,
yeah, she did.
Drake kind of did that.
Jay-Z
kind of did that. Like, so critics don't really have the time to kind of react to this, like, have advanced copies and listen. And they also quote Kendrick Lamar's album Damn from this year. Mm-hmm. They say, you're losing clicks every day that your review is not out. And thus, in an effort to kind of get reviews out faster, you reduce the quality of the reviews.
Yeah.
And then the thing is, obviously, movies themselves are kind of... Movies are amorphous, right? They don't have, for the most part, a face. Like, there's always multiple people involved in a movie. And oftentimes, directors aren't necessarily super active on social media. And there isn't, like, one voice of a movie, for the most part. Whereas that's not the case with music. You know, Drake is him. Like, the music is him. Whatever he does on social media is him. So artists, musicians can kind of control the narrative about their music by being active on social media and, like, engaging with critics. And that brings it to the next point, which is public shaming of critics on social media. So nowadays, angry musicians can easily kind of lash back towards critics, and they can mobilize their fans to kind of lash back towards the critics. And like, you know, critics often don't get paid a lot to write reviews. I mean, in our case, you know, we operate purely based on voluntary effort. And, yeah,
and it's just not worth it.
Yeah, it's not worth it. Like, a writer of ours was saying, like, he posted a negative review about a particular band in a festival, and, like, he got harassed by people. And
yeah,
that happens. Like, every time we post, like, a negative review of a big album, we get quite a bit of backlash. That is...
So, that's the part I wanted to add here. And I feel it has, like, two parts that isn't mentioned in this quite good article. One is that music, except for a few aficionados, like hardcore movie fans, music hits people closer to home.
Yeah.
Right? Think about your favorite movie. Well, maybe not you, because you are super into movies, right? But the normal person thinks about their favorite movie and their favorite album. There's really no competition regarding which thing is more emotionally important for them.
Well, yeah, I mean, a person will listen to their favorite album all the time, whereas your favorite movie, you'll watch it, like, I don't know, 5-10 times
yeah,
if you're really into it.
Yeah, so giving a negative review of that often carries a whole lot more backlash than giving a negative movie review. And as you said, it's just not worth it. And the second thing is, oftentimes critics, especially in our sort of community, which is a bit smaller, we're very close to musicians. Right?
Yeah.
I'm so much closer to even someone like, okay, I'll give you an example. We just released our Leprous review, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I'll be completely honest with you. Like, I sat with Einar and Tor in the same room. I met Einar when I was at B-Prague, and mm-hmm, I felt bad. Like, I was so nice to them when we met, and they were so nice to me, and we hung out and we spoke. And now I turn around and this album, they've spent a lot of time on it, obviously. I give it a negative review. There's a part of you that's like, this is kind of shitty.
Yeah.
And even with artists that are even bigger, the space between you and that musician is so, so much shorter than between, I don't know, someone who writes for Vice about movies and Ben Affleck.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Like, there's no comparison. I'm not saying, like, if you review Michael Jackson, well, you won't review him, but if you review a living famous musician, that's okay. But
Elvis Presley.
But most musicians aren't like that. They don't have that divide.
Yeah.
So those are the two aspects I wanted to bring in here. And, you know, I kind of want to make readers read this article and say, could you just maybe be a bit nicer to us? Like,
yeah,
not to bitch too much. Like, on the Leprous review, for example, someone, you know, made a comment that is essentially, like, theoretically, it isn't a non-legitimate thing to say, but the way that they said it was just so aggressive and offensive. Like, this is not heavy enough for you? Who cares? I mean, what?
Yeah, I got something similar with the Winterson review that I did, where I was like, I didn't complain that the songs were too long. I said that, you know, these songs could easily be split up into smaller pieces, and they're too repetitive, so their length drags on, and the pacing of the album is bad. And the comment was like, oh, if you didn't like long songs, then maybe you shouldn't have listened to Winter Sun. Like, dude, like a few days before that, I wrote praises to the Ingurgitating Oblivion album and its 22-minute long song. I love the first Winter Sun album. I talk about how much I love that album pretty frequently. And yeah. like, how the fuck do you reach that conclusion from there? And then, like, God.
And how the fuck do you post it? Like, I mean, I know that this is a very small problem within the toxicity of online communities. And you and I aren't exactly in the groups that usually get hate. So, but that being said,
and just, I mean, we should post ourselves, to be honest.
Yeah. But like, just take a fucking second and consider the fact that there's a person on the other end and who spent probably a lot of time with this album. You know, we don't just hear an album once and then review it. If we hear an album and it's so bad that we just don't review it. Yeah, exactly. We can't even listen to it again. That's why
you and I aren't reviewing the new Contortionist album.
Yeah, exactly. By the way, that album sucks. Anyway, that's my review. This is shit. That's my review. Stop. Delete your account. we should post that.
Just post that on Contortionist's wall.
Oh my god, as a heavy blog.
Yes.
Anyway,
after Jimmy's positive review hits.
Yeah. The last thing I wanted to say is kind of bring it full circle and say, you know, we're part of this quote-unquote problem, wherein a lot of our reviews are positive, and we have a name for ourselves in the community as those guys who love everything. Mm-hmm. And a few things here. One, I'd love to be that guy.
There's two other points left in the article. I just want to go with that, and then you can bring it whole circle with that. One thing they say is that pop stars have like really big Twitter followings, and if they like post a positive review, that will drive traffic to that site, and like, you know, traffic is money, and that is an incentive for some people. And again, in this case, like, you have a way close, the movie studios are way more distanced than critics than music is, so like posting a bad review can often negatively affect your relationship with those people and your ability to get a review copy in the future, which affects your business. And so it basically kind of highlights this pretty parasitic relationship between the critic and the journal and the music creator, and also basically shows that how musicians kind of control more of the space in here. And yeah, so positive reviews, we were saying, continue.
Yeah, so one, I don't mind being that person who writes favorable reviews. I think that a lot of music coming out today is great, especially within the genres that we usually take a look at.
Mm-hmm.
Second thing is, you need to understand that for us to write a review, we need to listen to an album sometimes 20, 25 times.
We don't get paid to do this.
Exactly. Well, I was going to say it in a much more left Twitter kind of way. Fuck you, pay me. I mean, if you want me to review bad albums, then pay me to sit yeah. around and listen to shit albums. And until then, I will review like stuff that I like. And we do post negative reviews. That usually happens when it's a band that we really loved or do love, or it's a sensation, stuff like that. But yeah.
And we always get treated like we were haters shit posting about the band that we never liked them to begin with. That's almost never the case.
Yeah.
And the thing is, I had some good point to make that I fucking forgot. I remember. Go ahead. We post a finite amount of reviews, right? We post one, maybe two reviews a day. That means we can only review so many albums. And in fact, there are not enough good albums. We don't have enough review slots to review all the good music that comes out.
Yeah.
Like, to be able to get to the albums that we don't want to promote, by promote I mean show that is good, we would have to review even more albums, which is just not feasible for us. So it's basically like a numbers game at that point. Like, we want to review the albums that we think are good and we want to give publicity to, but we don't, if we do that, we just don't get to the bad albums. Like, if an album is bad, we'll just be like, okay, yeah, cool, I guess we'll kind of schedule this for a review if there's ever like a drought, and there never is a drought because there's always so much awesome music.
Yeah, and the last thing I want to say here is that, how shall I put this? Need to be careful here. You need to realize that we are part of a mechanism, right?
Yeah.
We are part of an industry. And saying that you would like us to exist on a platonic plane where we sit in our wizard's tower and albums kind of flutter in the room and then we send them back into the wild and we have no relationship with this force that brings us music is fine, but that's not the case. The case is that there are people out there who we have relationships with. They give us albums. And yeah, I'm not saying that if we post a negative review, then some PR company will stop working with us. But when we do post a positive review and they have great quotables they can take from that review and they can share it on social media and they can be proud of it, that incentivizes them to keep working with us.
Yeah.
So on one end, I don't want to be super cynical and say that's why we sometimes give positive reviews, because it's not. If an album is bad, I won't give it a positive review just because I like its PR film. But on the other hand, I don't want to be naive and say, oh, that completely doesn't affect me. I never know who's giving me promos. I never take into consideration when I review an album, because that's just not the case.
Yeah.
There is a give and take. There is a relationship that we have to take into account. Sometimes we don't. Sometimes an album is so fucking bad that we just say, I can't in all good decency review this album favorably. And I'll tell you the truth. If it's a friend of ours, the band or the PR company, we're less likely to review it.
Yeah.
Unless it's so egregiously bad or it's like a huge band or something and we feel it's important, then we'll say, okay, the relationship notwithstanding, we really, really have to review this and we will anyway. Also, I said this is the last point, but I have another one, which I think is very important. This entire conversation presupposes that this is the binary. Good albums, bad albums.
Yeah.
And this is why we got rid of our scoring system. If you would like to reduce our reviews to this is a good review and then all good reviews are the same, don't read Heavy Blog. Don't read the blog. Yeah. Because every good review is its own article with its own reasons and its own analysis. Not saying that there's no similarity points at all, but if you just think that what matters is whether it's a good or a bad album, just don't read the blog because it's a waste of your time.
Yeah. Just go listen to the album.
Don't read Heavy Blog, Eden Cooper Mintz, 2017.
What you can do, though, is go listen to my album. We are not going to be reviewing it, probably, because it's probably not very... Ethics in metal journalism. But yeah, my album came out, Entropy of Chaos and Salt. I am so happy that it's actually
very good. It's very good.
Yes, thank you.
Please listen to it.
Please continue to sing my praises.
I will.
I will kind of self-deprecate by being an asshole now. So I am really made happy by the reception. Some people have messaged me with some amazing things. I really like it. But god damn it, why do I have so many international fans? No, like, I'm really glad that people are, like, the shipping costs are exorbitant to ship an album internationally. It costs more to ship the album than the album costs to, like, some countries. But yet people are buying that, and I'm very grateful for them. But this is the first time I've ever, like, done something like this, right? I'm all doing this by myself, and obviously a lot of independent bands do this. It's like, whoa, look at me cry, whatever. But like, I'm learning the ropes as I go along. And man, this is some tough stuff. I have more respect for other independent artists now, because like trying to ship like 50 packages overseas at the same time is hell. Like,
that sounds like a nightmare.
Yeah. And especially if you don't have like a, you know, like a contract or something you can go through, like a label or whatever, where you just send it out and they go. No, I have to like manually sign the customs form for every single one of them. It's pretty amazing. And then what happens is like I go to the post office, like drop off all these like this huge batch of CDs, come back home and there's like 5 new orders. I'm like, it's like tragicomic, right?
I mean,
I'm happy and frustrated at the same time. I'm so glad that people actually like my album.
Yeah, it sounds like a nightmare.
Yeah, and this is the worst like Venn diagram intersection of the humble brag and the ungrateful asshole. But yeah, I'm actually very happy that people like this, because so when Eventuality came out, it was hard to kind of gauge the reaction to it, because, you know, I had less Facebook fans back then, and that was like the only medium with which I interact with people. And, you know, some people stream the album, some people buy it on Bandcamp, and I see some numbers, but it's hard to kind of gauge what that really is. But now it's a lot, like when you're actually holding physical products and shipping them out, it feels so much more tangible. Like, I don't know if it's like completely mental on my end, but it is a completely different experience. And honestly, I've kind of alluded to this publicly and mentioned it to you and others privately, that like making this album was incredibly draining for me.
Yeah.
Creatively and like in many aspects, I put so much into this, and that the fact that people are, you know, actually appreciating this, and I get such a positive reaction from people, is honestly, if that didn't happen, I don't think I would be able to make more music ever again. Like, I would have just stopped.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's hard. Like, the whole relationship that the artist has with their music. Yeah, we talk about this all the time on the podcast, obviously, but actually going through that process is something else.
Yeah, I mean, it's completely not the same thing, because my relationship with the project I'm a part of is very different from yours, obviously. And I don't put not even half, like 10% of the effort that you put in to your project than I put into InStyle. But still, like, there was a time right after when I recorded my narrations and I first heard it on the tracks, that I wanted to message Greg and just say, just delete everything. Just delete everything. Just fly over here and rip out my vocal cords, because I suck. And that was also really hard for me, because all of the stuff on there is like poetry and stuff that I wrote. It's very personal for me. And it kind of felt like I couldn't go back and even read those things. Mm-hmm. Right? Because I felt that I had ruined them somehow. So, and then I try and imagine how I would feel if I was less of an emotionally stable person, right?
Yep.
And then you kind of start to maybe understand or empathize with, you know, musicians who have developed mental issues because of their music, right?
Yeah.
So it doesn't really create it, but it kind of feeds into already existing patterns and really bolsters them and amplifies them.
Yep. Thankfully, there have been very few, if any, negative reactions at all, and I'm really happy for that, because I don't think I would have been able to take them.
There was that guy who complained about the drums.
Yeah,
that's... And I was like, dude, first of all, what a fucking cliche. A metal fan complaining about drums. It's like metal fan 101. And like choosing the one thing on the album that doesn't have an actual musician like playing the instrument behind it and nitpicking that is so stupid.
And I mean, I tried to walk the balance between kind of having it be ridiculously technical, but also kind of humanely playable. And obviously, it's not always on the right side of the spectrum for that necessarily. But, you know, I think I'm not a purist of like, if you can't do it live exactly, then it doesn't matter. Like, I think the experience of listening is everything to me, especially kind of when I'm composing these songs. That's what I hear in my head, right? I don't envision myself going on stage playing this with like four other people. To me, it's all about the listening experience. So that's what I care.
So okay,
if you are about the listening experience, one website that you may not want to visit or may not be able to visit in the near future is SoundCloud.
Yes.
So we mentioned about the SoundCloud financial troubles and how supposedly Chance the Rapper swooped in and saved them, but we were like, no, not really. So there is more news. So the first news item that came out was that basically, obviously, the Chance the Rapper thing didn't work out. And the SoundCloud investors held a meeting on Friday to vote on whether to just terminate the company.
Or accept a rescue.
Yeah, so SoundCloud basically asked for $170 million. And by the way...
So the details are clear. Like, the $170 million are from a new investor coming in. And when that happens, the old investors, whose share of the company then gets deprecated, they have to vote to allow a new investor to come on board.
Mm-hmm.
So if they vote no, then the new investor is blocked and the company dies. If they vote yes, the company lives, but all of the investors are pissed off because their value just got deprecated.
And also, the $170 million is way above the actual valuation of the company. So it's basically asking for charity. And additionally, that would mean that the CEO, the current CEO, would probably be fired. And also, the company has burned through over $230 million over the past years. And they also have a $70 million debt.
Yeah.
Accruing interest.
And Alex Leung is indeed gone.
Yes. So what happened later that day is they actually voted. And the end result is that, SoundCloud received the $170 mil. They got a new CEO, Carrie Trainor, who's formerly from Vimeo, apparently. And Vimeo is an okay service, right? Like,
we're beyond the question of qualities here. This is finances. Vimeo is very successful.
Yeah. So basically, it is the biggest not YouTube.
Yeah. And they also have Michael Weissman, who was also at Vimeo.
Mm-hmm.
He's going to be the chief operating officer.
Mm-hmm.
But if you are getting the white and orange colored flags out, by the way, that's also LivePerson's colors, so that's a bit amusing. The company I work for is also white and orange. If you're like starting the celebration, then don't. This is not good news.
Well, this is bad news in general, but also will affect SoundCloud. So basically, they're bringing the Vimeo approach to SoundCloud. Apparently, they want to kind of have people monetize their videos, and they're going to charge people to put content on the site. So say goodbye to the free just dump your dank memes or shitty mixtape SoundCloud. You're going to have to pay for it. So yeah, it's going to be interesting to see how this changes. And we keep talking about how, you know, Tidal is maybe failing, Spotify is scamming people, SoundCloud is dying, but all of it seems kind of nebulous and like it's never going to happen. But this did happen.
Yeah.
That's it.
And beyond what they'll do with the model and paying nothing, this also isn't good for the company.
Yeah.
Like a company this size that needs a cash injection, that's something that is usually reserved for startups, like small startups. At this point, you should be looking at going public. And you can't do that when you keep needing a cash injection. That's one. Two, changing a CEO is always a really tough move for a company.
Yeah.
As far as culture, the people who work there, it's very, very tough. Lots of people lose their jobs, as have already. And that brings me to my last point. This still doesn't change the fact that SoundCloud were assholes / allegedly, so we don't get sued, illegally hired people, right? Under false pretenses.
Yeah.
So that entire thing has not blown over. And even though they changed CEO, all of the VPs, all of the executive level are still the same people for now until they get fired and replaced. Right. So.
And if you do that, that's kind of like very aggressive surgery. So.
Yeah.
That is not going to be smooth for the people in the company. It's basically going to be a shitstorm.
Yep, so don't invest.
Speaking of storms, there's a new Enslaved song.
And it's actually amazing.
Yeah, so the song is called Storm Sun. And it is from their upcoming 14th studio album, E.
Named after me.
Yeah, sure.
The new studio album is named after me. End the discussion.
Okay. By the way, maybe you can explain this to me, being like the history nerd or whatever.
M?
Yeah.
I have no fucking idea.
So the album title is E, but they have it as an M on the artwork, so sideways E. And also the enslaved E is an upside down M, aka W. So I don't know. Explain this to me, man.
I don't know. I have no idea.
Runic whatever nerd.
I'm not a visual designer. I have no idea.
Yeah, but like maybe there's some sort of historical significance. Every time we talk about Nazis, you pull out some dank references about what rune comes from where.
I don't think the M is an actual rune. I don't know what's happening with them. I don't know what this cover is. Leave me alone.
So, okay. The concept for the album is, quoting Ivar Bjørnson, lies in both its meaning as a letter in the Latin alphabet and its runic reference, the rune Eowas, that is depicted as an M when drawn as a rune, just to make sure it gets really confusing. The runes are drawn to look like that what they literally mean. Eowas looks like and means horse, which is closely linked to its esoteric meaning, which is trust and cooperation. One of mankind's oldest and deepest pairings slash collaborations with any outside entities is with the horse. When they were first tamed and utilized, there must have arisen the notion of some esoteric link between the two. Now we could move swiftly, escape faster, and even eat and drink from the animal, both horse milk and horse blood. And of course, show off and brag before our enemies and peers with the most spectacular horses. So then he clarifies, so no, it is not about horses. It is about the symbioses that surround us, which are vital to our existence, our development on all scales, man and vessel. For instance, horse, yes. A person and a significant other, child and parent, musician and instrument, chaos and order, subconscious and conscious, Odin and Sleipnir, wisdom and communication. There are many levels and variations to this concept on the album. The duality of man and nature, present and past personalities within oneself, the conscious sphere and the subconscious drive, and other symbioses. So that's
I just want to say that these guys are like Shamash, right?
Yeah.
They know their fucking shit. Like, they put to shame all the 2-bit black metal artists with their neo-paganism bullshit.
Yeah.
Like, these guys are so on top of this stuff. It's really incredible.
By the way, there is a track called Sacred Horse on the album.
Do you know who loves this album?
Who?
Mike Pence. I had the whole thing with the horse.
So, by the way, the track list was Storm Sun, The River's Mouth, Sacred Horse. And like while glancing through the track list, I thought the track was called The Horse's Mouth. You know, like the
idiom. Let's talk about Storm Sun.
Okay, this song is not about horses from what I can tell. This is a really big departure for Enslaved, I would say.
Yes, but it works so well. So this is like Leprous, mm-hmm, plus Opeth,
yeah,
plus Enslaved.
So I like this a little bit less on repeat listenings because of the sheer repetition in the,
mm-hmm,
near the end of the song.
Yeah.
But I feel like it's going to lead into the rest of the album.
For sure.
So it's I'm not like being super negative. I still really like the song, and yeah, this kind of fills the hole that Leprous left. So their keyboard guy used to do clean vocals, and, mm-hmm, I think they replaced him with some other dude who also does clean vocals.
Yeah.
So the vocal style is pretty different on this album. Previously, it was more, for lack of a better word, specific. Like it, mm-hmm, was more defined. Whereas here, it's a bit more ethereal. And I don't know if that's going to turn out like that for the other tracks, but that also kind of highlights the difference in direction. But
and
I just want to say... Oh, sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, go ahead. No, go.
I just want to say, like, this band is like 14 albums into their career, and they're still making fresh and quality material. And they've,
yeah,
never not made fresh and quality material.
Yeah, Enslaved are incredible. And I feel like they're underrated. They're not small, but they're, mm-hmm, not as big as they should be.
Yeah.
Like, they should be in the annals of the big, big, big bands, and they're not. And that's a real shame. And the thing I want to say about the track itself, the synth tones are so good. That synth tone, Opeth synth tone that I miss so much when it's overlaid on top of heavy music, there, mm-hmm, isn't anything quite like it. I mean, I love that sound.
Oh,
it's
wait,
done
now
so
that,
well.
Now that I think about it, the song opens with a sample of a horse neighing.
Dude, can you let go of the horse thing?
I mean, I would, but clearly they can't. Okay, I'll stop horsing around.
Oh,
so,
my God. Horse son.
Okay. So,
fucking horses,
you know,
man.
You know what the name of this episode is, right?
Horses.
Sacred horse.
Sacred horse. From the horse's mouth, let's say that.
Nice.
Okay, so speaking of horses, there is no segue here. Finally, we break the streak of dank segues, but I kind of want to just go back to something. Like last time we went back to the Fractal Cypher album, The Human Paradox,
mm-hmm, yeah,
which was from late last year, and another amazing release from late last year was Shokran's album Exodus.
Yes.
So this is the Sumerian core band from Russia, mm-hmm, and this is their second album. It was a concept album about, guess what? Tell me what's
horses.
The concept.
Do you know what Muscovy's symbol was? The barony of Muscovy.
No.
It was Tell a me. Horse. It actually was a horse, though.
Do you know what Moses rode to get from place to place?
A chariot? A camel?
Probably, honestly.
Is that racist? So, Shukran's Exodus.
Yes.
It's not about horses. It's about the Exodus.
Yes. Woo! We got there. Yeah, so it's a really cool album. So the album is really short.
Yeah.
So it's I got kind of burnt out on it by listening to it way too much because I really love it. But obviously, after a little bit of time, I went back to it, and it's still super fucking amazing. Like,
yeah, it's all a these really good album.
Amazing Sumerian core type moments. The vocals are super cool, and every song is like totally its own thing. And it's just a super fun experience to listen to this album. It's just pure enjoyment.
Yeah, they really nail the idea of the bigger than life moments.
Mm-hmm.
Every track has a hook, like a big moving moment. For example, You Only Consist, is it, of Shame?
Yeah.
It's such a good moment. Like, and even though the lyrics can be somewhat grammatically awkward, they're always so sincere. Yeah. And you can tell that it's not because they didn't think about them, right? It's just because of their background.
They're Russian.
Right? Yeah. But it's so... Jesus Christ. It's so well done, and it really hooks you in. I think it's also a great example of an album that really nails home the message of you don't have to be stale to be technical,
mm-hmm.
and you don't have to be mature to make interesting music. You can have fun and write heavy stuff and also be impressive and well thought out and executed. So, it's a really good album.
Yeah, and the Russian thing is completely... I'm friends with Dmitry and Andrei, and they're good people.
Yeah,
I mean, you know... Actually, that kind of goes into something that I kind of wanted to talk about. And I know you want to talk about call-outs, but I don't care, so I'm just going to take over. So, they're, like... I don't know how to frame this, but... Basically, I guess what I call it was minor random things that a band does that just instantly gets you on board.
Yeah.
Like, some, for example, clean vocals over blast beats. Like, anytime I hear that, I'm in immediately. Yeah. Opeth, Enslaved, Native Construct, Trivium, kind of. And even there's a Periphery song from the latest album. Something news, something. Do you know the name of that song?
Yeah, whatever.
Yeah, that one has like clean vocals over blast beats, and I really dislike Periphery, but I really like that moment. So yeah, that is like one thing that will always sell me on a song, regardless.
So let's do one.
Yeah. Okay.
So for me, it's slides, and when you take the pick and you slide it on a string like Gojira does.
Yeah.
So I really like it when a band does one or two to really like mark the heavy parts. And that's the reason that I love from Gojira's Terra Incognita.
Mm-hmm.
Because they have less of that on that album. It's before they like used it all the time.
Yeah.
And then when that riff comes in, tagadam, tagadam, woo, and then the heavy part hits, I'm like, I'm so in, guys. I'm so fucking in. It's incredible, and a lot of bands do that really well. What's that Gojira homage band? Sanzu.
Yeah.
Sanzu sure do that. That's what they are, man.
Yeah.
They're really good, by the way. Really fucking good. And they do those slides. Oh, man, drives me crazy. I love that.
You mean the pick scrape or the slide?
Scrape.
Scrape, okay. Yeah, cool.
I knew the term, but it escaped me.
The new FFA, Fit for an Autopsy album. Has some of that as well. And that album is kind of like a Gojira core album anyway.
Yeah.
And I think Morbid Angel are kind of the band that pioneered that sound way back in... I want to say Once Was Not, but that's a Cryptopsy album. Fucking forget the name of the Morbid Angel album. Fuck. In the meantime, let's think about who did clean vocals over blast beats first. That's probably hard to nail down.
Wow, that's impossible. Yeah, that sounds hard to...
Formula's Fatal to the Flesh was the first time I heard that pick scrape thing. As for Cleans Over Blast Beats, and the new Akakok album has a decent amount of that as well.
Your review goes live tomorrow, right?
Fuck. Does it?
Yeah, it does.
Okay. I guess it does. Yeah, totally. Yeah, cool. I'll do that, pack for my trip, edit this podcast, edit the video I shot yesterday for a 9 song. Fuck. Okay. Cool. So, yeah, I can't really nail down what the first blast beat with clean vocal thing probably feels like. It should be either some like weird old school prog death metal band.
Yeah.
Or like something like Opeth.
Yeah, Watchtower.
Yeah, I don't think they did blast beats a lot.
No, I'm joking.
Yeah. Okay. So the reason I made the like Russian thing is like kind of foreign language, foreign air quotes, non-English segments with like atmospheric elements just really drive me. Like if there's like a spoken word segment in some other language, that just really drives me in for some reason. That kind of really enhances the atmosphere for me.
Yeah.
There are many examples of this. Like it's not a super specific thing that any band characterizes, because if you kind of build this, when you build your sound around this, then it stops being special. But like in general, stuff like that is pretty cool to me.
Yeah, I love really complex and articulated bass underneath tremolo picking.
Mm-hmm.
So when a black metal band does like a really drawn out guitar part, but the bass is just going crazy,
mm-hmm.
the Spectral Lore do that a lot. And you can really hear the bass. It doesn't have to be technical, but just articulated. You know what I mean? Like
yeah.
the bass has a lot of phrasing and a lot of variety, and the guitar is just, you know, tremolo picking with delay. I really love that. And a lot of post-rock bands do that, and post-metal bands.
Along those lines, I really like really prominent fretless bass in the sound, obviously. Oh, yeah. I mean, that's, you know, this is a pretty common thing to like, but
yeah.
like, not just really prominent bass, which something like Viramia does, for example, but like having it be fretless and do those like really slidey types of things, which is more common these days than it used to be. Right? I think Cynic was like a big starting point for that sound. Obviously, they're not the first artist to do it. But
Atheist.
Yeah, Atheist, Cynic, anything with Steve DiGiorgio, basically. That was kind of like a big sound for that, but it kind of went away for a while. But in, I think in, with the like new tech death boom of the mid 2000s, mid late, it really kind of came back. Obscura's Cosmogenesis album really popularized that again. But I think the best example of it is probably Beyond Creation, obviously. Like that is what they define their sound on, to the point that, you know, their guitar playing is actually not that intricate for the most part. Like the bass playing is usually what drives their sound, and that is just really cool to me. Kind of in general, having counterpart, which is a musical term for basically means different instruments are playing completely different things that are kind of revolving around each other instead of complementing each other directly.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of that in general is great, but when bass also participates in it, because a lot of bands do that with guitar, kind of Necrophages popularize that sound, I guess, but when you pull the bass into that sound as well, then it becomes like, oh yeah, I'm in. I tried to do that with my album actually, but two things happened. With too much keyboard, there's just not enough room in the sound for bass.
Mm-hmm.
And secondly, there was too much stuff that I didn't really want to write bass that took away too much from. So here and there you can kind of hear the bass, but for the most part, I kind of, after I got Jimmy on board, I was like, I should do this with Jimmy instead. So you hear more like key / guitar interplay instead of guitar / bass interplay.
Yeah. I really like it when tracks end with super prominent vocals and the music dies underneath it.
Hmm.
So for example, on Mythos, when the stars align,
and
the music dies, right?
Yeah.
Lots of prog bands do that. And there's a really intense riff just before that, and the vocals pick up, and then everything cuts away, and you just get the last line of the vocals alone. Oddland do that on the latest album. Also, Back to Days of Splendor, Days of whatever. What's the name? Come on.
Disillusion.
Disillusion, they do that on Splendor a few times. It's really good. I love it. It's just a great way to finish a track.
By the way, Disillusion are apparently touring with Myra. I don't know. Is that how you pronounce that band's name?
I think so, yeah. Not a huge fan.
Yeah, oh, okay. I thought you would be more into them.
Yeah, I should be, but I'm not. I don't know why.
Okay, I guess like one or two more, maybe. Yeah. I'm trying to think of what else there
I have be. One.
Oh, okay, you go ahead.
Backing vocal harmonies a la Mike Portnoy, Petruzzi, Labrie. So when the vocalist is doing something really in high register, mm-hmm. and the backing vocals kind of pick the scales beneath him mm-hmm. and harmonize over that. Obviously, Transatlantic do that because they have Portnoy and Neil Morse. But also the Flower Kings do that. A lot of old school prog bands. Mm-hmm. Yes, did that. Jeff Hotal, stuff like that. It's such a cliche thing to like. It's such like the basic but I think, thing.
So that is more interesting to me than something like the same vocalist harmonizing in the same region, which a lot of like modern gent type bands like to do. But I think it's more interesting when you have different voices kind of operating in different spectrums of the sound.
Yeah. The kings of that, well, the king of that is Daniel Gillenlaw, Pain of Salvation. Like having his own vocals, they're not harmonizing. They're doing several things on the track sometimes at the same time, but they're complementing each other. Mm-hmm. It's kind of like a vocal counterpart, if you will.
Yeah.
They revolve around the same ideas, but they're not harmonizing. It's not an actual melody.
So for me, another thing would be, I really love surf rock. I've mentioned this like very few times actually, but yeah, I'm huge into surf rock. So anything that has like a either surf rock or swing or flamenco rhythm/interlude, I will instantly be into it. Like First Fragment have a lot of swing sections, for example, right?
Yeah.
And the new Neoblo Viscar song has kind of a flamenco vibe in the opening. The previous August Burns Red album, Found in Faraway Places, has a lot of kind of, not a lot, but several surf rock type sections. And I try to do that in my sound as well. But, if you have any sort of that type of kind of groovy, clean guitar with a Mediterranean-ish vibe, then I'm just super, super into that. But yeah, especially with the particular rhythms of, swinger, surf or something like that.
So the last thing for me, and this is something I've been very passionate about for a very long time, when the groove section, that is the bass and the drums, are audible during guitar solos and do really cool things with rhythm.
Mm-hmm.
So when the solo is not just the drums and the bass doing 4/4, you know, just playing the beat of the track to let the solo shine, but they interact with the solo and mm-hmm. add a really huge groove to it. I just, that makes the solo so much better for me. Because the guitar solo can often be, okay, this note is going to go on for a few more beats and I already know where it's going because I can kind of extrapolate it.
Yeah.
Because it's a whistle or it's climbing a scale or whatever. And then I can listen to the bass and the drums doing really cool things with the groove. And they hit the same note as the solo when it comes back. Right? So the solo has lots of shredding, but then it does one of the chords from the track, and the bass and the drums hit on the one on that chord. That drives me crazy.
So my last thing along those lines is basically drums that are way too good for the rest of the song. And I don't mean this in a negative context. When the guitars are playing something pretty basic, but the drums are just going completely nuts.
Yeah,
I really love that. So that was like originally one of the biggest reasons that I was super into Trivium, because on Ascendancy, like, the drumming was way above the level of the guitars for the most part. Yeah. Like, that's kind of what put that album over the top for me, because, like, you can imagine a version of that album which was played by, like, Killswitch Engage's drummer or whatever, and it would be way less interesting, and that's kind of one of the bigger reasons why I didn't like Silence in the Snow. And the new song, Sin in the Sentence, actually has like really good drumming, and that really makes a difference. Yeah. Another example would be Quo Vadis, and they're already a tech death band, so there it's kind of high bar. But I think a big reason of them having that type of sound is because, like, oftentimes the guitars will play just thrash or melodeath riffs, but the drumming will go just completely insane with the riffs. Like, if you listen to Silence Calls the Storm, was that the name of that song?
I'm not a big Quo Vadis fan.
The the first song from their last album, Defiant Imagination. That, like, the drummer Yannick Bercier is completely ridiculous. And yeah. And also, I want to highlight a new band with this. Not a new band, a band. So I mentioned Yannick Bercier was the drummer in Covadis before the band kind of dissolved. He has a band called Gone in April. I don't know if you've heard of this band.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
So Yannick's on drums. Steve DiGiorgio is on bass.
Oh, nice.
Mark from Covadis is on guitar. He's like the other guitar player. And they have two vocalists. One lady who also plays the violin. And a dude who does the screaming. So it's a really weird sound that this band has. It kind of combines Covadis style tech death with like Nightwish style gothic metal with some synth elements. It's really weird, and it really works because again the drumming is so ridiculous, and Steve DiGiorgio has ridiculous bass playing, and you have these kind of tech deathy guitars, but then you have the whole like gothy female singing segments. Then it goes into like synths and some violin and like then screaming with blast beats and whatnot. It's ridiculous. Like it's not supremely over the top like you would see in something like, can't think of anything right now, but like it's never like incredibly over the top. So you're never like, wow, this is amazing. Right. But it's just so well crafted and in how kind of well it all blends. So they have an album from 2016 called Threads of Existence.
Check that out.
It's really cool. I definitely recommend checking it out. If you, like, I know this sounds like a weird mix, but it totally works out. And if you're into tech death, but also want that kind of ethos applied to music that is not necessarily tech death, then you should definitely check this out.
Cool.
Yeah.
Well, cool people time.
Yeah, let's go.
Okay. So was it? No, I think I finished Quantum Thief in between episodes, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So I finished Quantum Thief. And it was even better on my second read through.
Dude, it's amazing.
Yeah, it's so good. Like, the first time I read it, I was all for it, but I was kind of too young. And
it is a really intense book.
Yeah, and I didn't have a lot of space opera experience, so a lot of the tropes that you have to take into stride kind of stood out like a sore thumb. But this time around, where I've not only read a lot of space opera, but also like deconstructions, and this is kind of a reconstruction.
Yeah.
And it's really, really, really well made. It embraces the cheesiness of the genre and pulls it off with really interesting ideas. You can really tell that Hanu is a computer scientist. He knows what he's writing about, but he didn't go the Peter Watts direction. Mm-hmm. Even though I love Peter Watts, Peter Watts does sacrifice some of the color in his writing in favor of...
It's too hard.
Yeah, in favor of technical rigorosity.
Yeah.
And Hanu, while I wouldn't say that the Quantum Thief is technically rigorous, manages
it's
to...
It's super fantasy. Like, it's the whole technology that is so advanced that it's basically magic.
Yeah. But it kind of manages to keep that flair and color in the writing and still mingle it with enough technical possibility, I'll call it, right? Technical. Mm-hmm. It's not completely implausible. Like, it rests on actual principles.
Mm-hmm.
And it's one of the only books where quantum featured in any meaningful way that didn't make me cringe. Like, at some point, science fiction decided that quantum is like another category after adamantium. Like, quantum is stronger. And Hanu's like, yeah, my guys have quantum ammunition, which basically means absolutely nothing. But it actually utilizes principles of actual quantum mechanics to say interesting things about how weaponry would look using that. And it has a lot of cool cryptography stuff and cool characters, cool ideas. Mm-hmm. The world that it draws, I want to give a talk about this. Like, I could go on for an hour about this. But, like, the balancing of the scale, how it paints a really wide canvas, but then chooses the tiniest detail and focuses on that. Really well made. I've already ordered The Fractal Prince and The Causal Angel, which I haven't read.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm really looking forward to that. And now I'm reading The Erstwhile, which is the sequel to The Vor
Oh yeah.
Which you didn't love.
Yes. Wait, before we move on to that, I want to talk a little bit more about the Quantum Thief series, Jean Le Flambeur series, sorry. Yeah. What I really like, and I've mentioned this loosely a few times before again, I really like hyper-modernized takes on classic fiction.
Yeah.
Like, the Count of Monte Cristo is like one of my favorite tales ever, but I really like weird versions of it, right? And like similarly, I will really enjoy any sort of postmodern take on something like Romeo and Juliet. So I really like that each one of these books is an homage to a classic tale and a classic mm-hmm. format. And like there's beyond just the story itself. There's,
hold on, wait, expand. The Quantum Thief is a homage.
I forget. We did this the last time.
So, yeah, it's a homage to the French Sherlock Holmes.
Arsène Lupin.
Yes.
But no, also, the format of it was an homage to something else as well. Fuck, I forget. Anyway, that, and, okay, I was saying, each book in this series is, beyond the plot itself, stylistically really interesting. Like with...
Oh, you're talking about, like, a heist novel?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, so in general, kind of, he plays literary games along with, like, mind games, is what I want to say. And again, like, the Fractal Prince is, you'll see, it's, like, the very direct riff on the 1001 Nights.
Yeah.
It's just really fantastic, and I just love the series so much. I can't wait for you to finish it so we can, like, talk about it in depth. And by the way, he has a new book coming out at the end of this month.
Oh, cool.
Called Summerland. It's not related to this stuff. It's I don't understand. It takes place in the 1930s, but but like there's technology that lets people evade death, and it's about the afterlife. So it's like really weird. I have no idea what it's going to be about, but we'll see.
Cool. Sounds good.
Yeah. Go ahead.
So the second novel, Erstwhile. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to go into detail into what the fuck this is. So Alan Moore's blurb of it, of the first one, is a fever dream. And I feel like that's a really good comparison for better and for worse. Imagine Philip K. Dick surrealism, mm-hmm. but by someone who fell in love with The Jungle Book when he was a kid. He references Kipling several times during the book. And by the way, people don't remember this, but The Jungle Book, the original book, is fucked up.
Yes.
Kipling was a total weirdo, and the original book is disconcerting to the highest degree. Very surreal, very like man becomes beast and beast becomes man and unchecked emotions, and it's really, really weird. So the Vol is possibly the Garden of Eden, in Africa, and mm-hmm. all sorts of weird shit happens around, like bends time and space and causality and stuff like that. And in the first book, we get like references to this race of creatures who might be the angels that were guarding the Tree of Knowledge. And when they fucked up, God forgot them. And when God forgets something, it starts to deteriorate. Like God is, you know, the Gnostic idea that God is completeness, God is the right way. And then if you turn away from it, you mutate, you deteriorate. And those guys are called the Erstwhile. The second book is all about them. Don't read it if you didn't like the Vol. It's kind of that, but more. However, you can really see that he grew as a writer. It's a bit less overwhelming, just for being overwhelming's sake. And I'm 40 pages in, and there's a passage that you would really love, where he plays with a mechanical creature and its biological form. Really, really interesting. So if you like surrealism, if you want to be challenged or maybe harassed by the book that you read, you should pick up The Vol.
Cool. Have you seen any movies or anything that you want to talk about?
I still need to go see Dunkirk.
Yeah.
I just keep postponing it. I don't know why.
Dunkirk Donuts.
I still haven't seen Wonder Woman.
I haven't either. I mean, I kind of just don't want to invest in the DC cinematic universe just because of one movie that's probably okay.
Yeah. I agree. I've been playing a lot of Total War, like we said last week.
Yes.
The new content is phenomenal. They really nailed down the faction. They did really clever stuff with the starting territories that give you freedom to wander around, because the Norska's hero, he has a really cool storyline, by the way. He's the internal challenger. So he's been cursed by the gods, so he can't die. So he walks the earth challenging the most powerful creatures to kill him because he wants to die.
Mm-hmm.
So capturing that could have been very awkward, because oftentimes in Total War games, you have to stay around your territory, right? Because there's rebellion and shit like that. And they made your starting territories really unassailable, freeing your main character to wander the world and fight cool quest battles and shit like that. Really well done.
So one thing that we may want to talk about is PlayerUnknown's Battlegrounds.
Yeah, we played like 4 games.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was fun. I enjoyed it.
Yeah, so I think the first-person mode is more fun.
Yeah, I agree.
But the game's like, for how unpolished it is, it feels surprisingly good.
There's also nothing there, really,
yeah,
content-wise, but it still feels very satisfying. One, because the shooting is very good.
Mm-hmm.
It gives you a lot of impact and feedback. And two, the variance of the map, that it's different every time, and the environments are also very, very varied.
Yeah, and also, like, basically, all of it comes from the fact that it just lets people do whatever they want, and, like, the scenarios just emerge from the constraints of the gameplay. So, like, they've achieved so much with so little, and it's pretty great.
Yeah, I agree.
One thing that I wanted to highlight for myself is, finally, this week, Hearthstone, which is the Blizzard's Warcraft card game.
Mm-hmm.
New expansion about the Knights of the Frozen Throne came out, and that's, you know, the Arthas Lich King stuff.
I've heard good stuff.
It's so good. It's like the best expansion they've done so far, and I'm just really happy. There's so much cool stuff in there. I'm playing.
I want to get into it, but I don't have time. I have too many games.
And money, honestly. it is not a cheap game to participate in, necessarily.
Yeah.
But, like, one good thing that they've done over the time is, like, originally there were a few classes that felt really cool and fun to play, and some of them were just lame and bad. But now every class is interesting to play. There's just so much cool stuff, and they've added a lot more depth to the game. And finally, I feel like the game has kind of found its own voice, right? It's not just worse Magic the Gathering anymore. It's kind of its own thing with a bunch of mechanics that they've added that can only be achieved in a digital format. If that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Sure. Like randomness, for example. Like, it's basically like create a random card, right? That you can't do that with a physical card game. So yeah, I'm really happy with it. If anybody wants to play with me, just comment on the podcast and we'll hook up and hang out. Cody loves it. I play with Cody all the time.
Yeah, I know.
All right.
Cool. Thank you for listening.
Cody just messaged me about Hearthstone. All right.
Nice.
See you guys later.
See ya. Bye-bye.